Hello and welcome to the Companies and Markets Show. My name's Ian Smith. I'm the Companies Editor of the IC. Joining me is a couple of the members of our company's team, our specialist writers, Emma Powell, who covers the financials. Hi, Emma. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks.
In the midst of a busy week covering the banks.
Yeah.
And all the other financial services companies to boot. And Jonas Crosland, who covers our property sector. How are you doing, Jonas?
Oh, fine, thanks. Yeah.
Okay, well, the one big piece of news this week had nothing to do with either of those sectors, but was in fact Kraft Heinz' approach and then withdrawal of its approach for Unilever, the massive consumer goods company. Emma, what happened here?
So it was a bit of a surprise on Friday when Kraft Heinz came out and said they would be making a part share, part cash offer for Unilever.
And surprising because Unilever is the larger company.
Well, yeah, exactly. So I think that was probably the most surprising thing about it. And it was an 18% premium, the offer, to the closing share price the day before the announcement was made.
And it would have been one of the biggest takeovers of all time.
Yeah, exactly. I think the second biggest takeover of all time.
So everyone got very excited about this.
Well, exactly. But then Unilever management quickly came out and issued a very firm rebuttal to the proposal, said that they didn't think it merited value for the shareholders. But what's kind of been interesting, I think, since that happened, is that Unilever has kind of faced some criticism for its margins, its profit margins. I think it was just today they've now come out and said they expect their core operating margin to be up the upper end of its guidance, I guess, in the face of that criticism.
And I think, yeah, it was actually late yesterday afternoon that they came out with that. And that was really interesting because part of the rationale for the deal would be that Kraft Heinz would have to strip a lot of costs out of the combined business in order to justify the premium they would be paying. And also then the amount of debt they'd have to raise to fund the deal. So a lot of people believe that they could actually do that because Unilever's operating margin is that much lower than Kraft Heinz, that there was wiggle room to do that. Although Unilever has been trying to improve its operating margin, it's got operational kind of strategy in progress. So it was quite interesting that they then turned around and said, oh, by the way, our operating margins are going to be at the upper end of the guided range, and we are looking at ways of getting shareholder value out of the business, which led some people to think maybe the foods division could be sold off. So rather than Unilever itself being taken over by Kraft Heinz, it could dispose of part of the business. So now that's very much the tenor of the debate.
Yeah, which is something we'll all be watching out for now. Again, that would still be a very big deal, even if it was just the food part of the business that was sold off.
And it does look like the share price perhaps is baking in something else happening. So the shares, although they fell back once Kraft Heinz withdrew its offer amicably, they didn't fall back to the point at which they started prior to the offer. So there might still be some people thinking there is a deal to be done here. So yeah, anyway, something to watch, plenty to interpret. And I suppose there's also the question of political involvement in the deal. I mean, Theresa May, when she was launching her leadership candidacy for the Conservative Party, was explicit that there should be a role for government in having a view to how foreign takeovers impact on UK businesses and the people that work for them. So although only a fraction or kind of a small segment of Unilever's employees are in the UK, it's very important within the UK economy as a producer, consumer goods supplier. So there was definitely a political angle there too. Yeah, something to watch. But let's talk about results. And we've picked a couple of core sectors because you guys cover those sectors this week. And there's been a bit of news and a few important results in the banks this season. So, Emma, why don't we start with RBS and what happened before the results season kicked off? News around the disposal of the retail bank, Williams & Glyn.
Yeah, so obviously one of the big stories coming out of the banking sector this week is RBS and its very kind of difficult disposal of Williams & Glyn, which is a challenger bank. It was part of their obligations as part of them getting the kind of the bailout that they would have to dispose of Williams & Glyn. But that's been kind of fraught with difficulties. It's suffered so many setbacks. There's, you know, they've been scrutinised by the Bank of England before, reportedly, because of the kind of technology risk of actually switching customers over to another lender. There's been CYBG and Santander that have made approaches or been, you know, looking at a potential purchase of part of Williams & Glyn.
So it's been a very drawn drawn out process.
Yeah.
And we saw that with TSB when that was spun out of Lloyds, and still they are working on that kind of IT transfer process. It's very difficult in these kind of enmeshed retail banking organisations. So it's quite interesting to see now that that was a real big factor impeding Williams and Glyn, but management are now confident, or they now have the option perhaps of not selling that operation and instead putting in place certain things that could encourage competition in a different way.
Yeah, so this was seen actually, the shares, you know, did receive a bit of a boost on the day this announcement was made, because it was seen as perhaps an easier option. The HM Treasury has kind of proposed to the European Commission, which is now looking at this option of an alternative package of measures, which would mean they wouldn't have to divest of Williams and Glyn by the end of December this year. That would cost RBS around 750 million, which they would take as a provision. But basically what it would mean is that they would provide funding to, say, other challenger banks to encourage customers to switch from RBS to these other certain eligible challenger banks. It'll be interesting actually to see what makes an eligible challenger bank. But yeah, like you said, it's to make it a lot more competitive within the kind of small to medium sized market. The other measures were customers of these challenger banks being able to use kind of cash and check handling services within Williams and Glyn branches, things like that.
Because that infrastructure point has been one for the smaller lenders where they said we haven't really got the same access as the larger banks. Now, RBS's results are coming out on Friday, which is might be the day this podcast reaches many people. But as part of those results, there's going to be a provision that they're taking against this process. So this process is still going to cost them over the long term. But in some way, the shares clearly suggested people thought it would be less of an impact than having to sell Williams and Glyn, which was a very problematic process.
I think part of the issue actually with RBS, as with other banks, is that there's just a huge cloud of uncertainty, I would argue, over RBS's kind of fate more than any other bank, because them having to divest of Williams and Glyn, how much that would actually impact them financially is a lot bigger uncertainty, I would say, than if they just did take this £750 million provision. And let's not forget, you know, we actually cover in the piece, that's not the only uncertainty they have. They've got this ongoing litigation in the US. That's a really big uncertainty.
We're waiting to find out how the size of the settlement with the US Department of Justice relating to the past mis-selling of mortgage-backed securities. So that could potentially be quite big. And that's one reason why the shares in RBS are trading below the forecast net tangible assets of the bank, right? The people are uncertain as to how much the book value of the company will take a hit from that, what is likely to be a massive settlement.
Yeah, they're making negative returns on equity also. But it's all these kind of legacy issues, which has, again, been a sector-wide issue.
But particularly tough for them. Well, let's talk about some of the banks that have reported, because there might be some hidden gems in RBS's results that we can talk about next week. But this week, a good week for Lloyds, a not-so-good week for HSBC. Let's take them in turn first, and then perhaps we can talk about Barclays, which came out today. But Lloyds, that's very much going with that process that we have been talking about for a couple of years now, or perhaps 18 months, of improving its capital position and paying back more of that capital to shareholders. It looks fairly simple. Is it that simple?
Yes and no. So, you know, it is a buy tip for us. And, you know, they're, I would argue, most far along the whole simplification process. You know, they're really focused on the kind of UK retail banking operations.
And where that, they have a big market share.
Exactly. And that does seem to be, you know, like the fact that they are the most well-capitalised bank now. Income is a big thing with them. And I think, obviously, shareholders would be happy. There was another special dividend, another increase in the ordinary dividend for 2016.
And this is the bull case for Lloyds. And we talked about this in a podcast that we published right at the beginning of last year, was that they would go back to boring as a bank. The idea that as they built up their capital, they spent years improving their balance sheet, they would now start to pay out more of that in dividends. And we've seen increases in the interim and final dividends, and now the second annual kind of special dividend, which is all amounting to what is still, you know, a fairly reasonable yield, but it means that Lloyds is firmly back in the income camp. And the bull argument, I suppose, going forward is, well, as payment protection insurance costs fall away, and as interest rates rise and they get a benefit from their retail banking operations as part of that, that the bank will have a lot more profit to hold back to be able to pass on to shareholders.
Yeah, and it's worth noting the big kind of drive behind that boost in pre-tax profits, which is, you know, is what a lot of shareholders look at, was the fact that PPI provisions were so much lower. They were about 1 billion rather than the 4 billion that they incurred the previous year. So that really helped. There is a couple of caveats, though, that I would kind of mention, and that's income for the retail banking operations was fairly flat. So I think that is something worth mentioning. And again, that's kind of down to the mortgage book and trying to protect margins. I mean,
because with a very we saw this in a few of the bank's results, a very competitive UK mortgage market, and anyone listening at the moment that's recently gone into remortgage will see that there is a lot of competition among the major banks around the rates that they're charging on mortgages. Now, this is limiting the profitability for a lot of the players, but Lloyds was able to mitigate this to an extent, right?
Well, yeah, exactly, they were. I mean, Lloyds does have the advantage that has such a large market share that it does have a slight competitive advantage. Its cost of funding was lower, which did help mitigate it. But, you know, at the same time, I think actually something that binds kind of all the banks, and we'll touch on this later, I'm sure, is the fact that income has not been that great. You know, it's mainly the ones that have really boosted their profits, the ones that have either suffered less provisions or, you know, have managed to kind of cut down their operating costs, rather than seeing any really big growth in income. Of course, that's, you know, to be expected to an extent, because we are in this kind of ultra low interest rate environment. So there's only so much they can do anyway.
Is the bear case that we're still trying to find out what the impact of Brexit will be? That's a big issue for Lloyds, because it being so exposed to the domestic economy, both in terms of consumer sentiment, but also in terms of the housing market. So that's potentially going to be quite negative for them. The interest rate improving environment is far from certain, because it will be responsive to the strength of the UK economy again. So there are still worries for Lloyds. And as you say, the income is not stellar that they're generating.
That exact reason that you just mentioned is the reason why they suffered such a big sell-off after the referendum result, because they are very exposed to whatever's going to happen within the UK economy. You know, the outcome of the Brexit negotiations, they are very exposed to that. So in some ways, it's been good, you know, what they've done with kind of cutting down their costs, becoming more simplified. But on the other kind of extent, I guess, is that
they're more exposed by that very nature.
They're less diversified than say other universal banks, okay, like HSBC.
Great seek to HSBC there. They also felt that same pressure in their UK retail banking operations from competition in the mortgage market, pushing down the margins they could make on that part of their business. But they were less able to mitigate it. So that was one of the areas that was a concern in these results that ultimately led to a fall in the shares. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, also that they suffered, I think it was a 62% fall in their pre-tax profits. Obviously, there, I would say, is, you know, one of the last kind of universal banks we've got still listed. There was a number of issues there, really. I mean, there was a lot of one-offs, so things like them disposing of their Brazilian operations, you know, that caused a big kind of hole in the profits.
But is it fair to say that the sell-off of the Brazilian operations and the reduction in their risk-weighted assets is something that people knew what progress they had made on that, but some of the negative surprise in the market was around the income from certain segments, and people looked at the underlying picture and said, well, actually the wealth management business isn't so hot and the retail banking business is not as strong in the UK, although in Asia it's growing new business well. What do you think people were responding to more specifically?
It was that income angle, I think, because, yeah, like you say, you know, the selling off of the Brazilian operations, well, that did kind of blow a little bit of hole in their income. Actually, yeah, it's that weaker sentiment that people didn't like, particularly around wealth management. I guess weaker investor sentiment, people weren't as confident, people were sitting on their hands a lot more. I think that was the surprise, and that was what actually really affected the income and the profits for the retail banking and wealth management business.
I suppose with these day moves or weekly moves, we need to set them in the wider picture. I think HSBC is up by about 50% over the past year as a result of recovery in the commodity markets to which it's exposed in the emerging market economies. And we saw part of that right with the write back of some of the provisions that they had taken. But, and I say with Lloyds, they haven't had that kind of as strong a year because of the Brexit vote having a big hit on their shares, although they are starting to recover again now. And just quickly before we move away from the banks, let's just talk about Barclays. Was there anything in HSBC and Lloyds that really transferred over to Barclays where they underperformed or overperformed?
So there were some similarities, like I said, with HSBC and Lloyds, and that's that income, you know, was fairly flat. All banks are struggling to kind of generate a good margin and generate good income again, because, you know, Barclays is one of those ones that's been on this whole simplification program, although they did keep some of their investment banking operations. I think what really,
which have actually done fairly well.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I remember, you know, the last set of results, that was actually a very surprising factor. But what's really kind of helped their profits this time is, again, it's less provisions they've had to take against kind of conduct and litigation costs. And that's, again, what's really helped them.
So we're starting to get a cleaner picture of these banks, do you think? There are always new costs that come out or new provisions, but do you think we're starting overall to get a clearer picture of the underlying trading?
I think so. I think that was inevitable after they went through this whole simplification process. Also worth noting is obviously Barclays' non-core operations. They're still running all of that off, and that was another big drag on profitability. But I think so. I mean, what's kind of really messed or kind of muddied the waters for banks is the fact that they have suffered for so long, so many, you know, impairments against loans, and that could be related to commodities crisis for people like HSBC. But then, you know, a lot of the retail banks having to take provisions for PPI, and people are really just waiting for all these kind of provisions and impairments to really just kind of run off, and I guess want kind of income to recover. Obviously, it's uncertain that to the extent that will actually recover with low interest rates.
But we've got some more piece of the puzzle.
Exactly.
Okay, and we look forward to your Barclays analysis piece, which will be in next week's magazine. But in this week, we have HSBC and we have Lloyds. Okay, Jonas, let's talk about house builders. You've reported on Barratt Developments this week. As you were out of the office, I reported on Bovis Homes, which is a company that I had recently written, taken stock column on too. Obviously, we have Persimmon, the largest listed house builder, and Taylor Wimpey, the second largest, coming out with results on Monday and Tuesday, respectively. So we can kind of talk about some of the things going on in the sector ahead of that. What do you think we learned from Barratt's results about the health of the sector overall and their progress on margins?
The wheels on the house building bandwagon continue to turn around very nicely. There have been some low whistles about high valuations, but nobody's prepared to put up their hand and say when the pillars of support will be taken away. That's high unemployment, high interest rates, the government cutting back on Help to Buy. As long as they all stay in place and there's a huge demand-supply imbalance, it's hard to see much, much change in the status quo.
And the housing white paper, do you see that as having much of an impact on that supply-demand question?
I don't think there's any silver bullet, because there isn't one single solution to the housing shortage. They are announcing bits and pieces, but I think the white paper was a little bit disappointing, because people were expecting a lot more.
And I suppose, as you say, the wheels on the bus keep turning. And for Barratt, what we saw there was decent returns that they are managing to generate for their shareholders.
Yeah, after the referendum, I mean, they read the newspapers like everyone else, and there were threats of recession and various collapse in house prices. So the first thing they did was cut back on the amount of money they spend on buying land, which of course meant they had lots of money, lots of free cash. And giving it back to the shareholders is it's a predictable move, because people forget that 10 years ago, 9 years ago, they were tapping their shareholders for money when they all had rights issues to keep in business. So giving it back to shareholders is a logical move. It's their money after all. But
is there a risk that that's a short-termist approach? That because of Brexit and related uncertainty, they are not buying land at a time when land prices are relatively benign, and actually they might come to regret that? Or do you think that's just good conservative approach because we don't know the impact that the Brexit negotiation process might start to have?
I think they get it in the neck if they do it either way, because if they start to build up big land banks, and most of them have 5, 6, 7 years supply, if they go up to 10 years, there's two problems there. One is that they'll attract criticism for sitting on land and not building on it, and two, it will affect the return on capital employed because money spent on dead land just doesn't earn any money. So I think they'll just sort of take along the middle ground there. Land prices will remain benign simply because the small house builders who used to participate in the market aren't there anymore. They all went out of business.
The other results, as I said, I reported on Bovis. Now, that was a company that issued a slightly disappointing trading update between Christmas and New Year, where they said that some production had slipped from 2016 into 2017. And there have been a fair amount of negative headlines around some of the customer service and snagging issues on some of their new build properties. Now, this result, it was quite interesting that they now, and we've also, I should say, seen the departure of the chief executive. Well, now the company has had to reduce its production guidance for 2017 to say we need to slow this process down, and they're putting into place a new customer service operation to make sure that they are answering customers' needs effectively and that they're delivering houses of sufficient quality on time. But they've had to slow things down to do so, which obviously then impacts on the return for their shareholders. What does Bovis tell us, I suppose, about the market? They tried to build perhaps faster, and they admit that their production processes couldn't really support their rate of growth. They tried to build faster and more than they were perhaps capable of doing. Is that potentially going to be a real risk with other house builders in the sector?
All it shows us is that you can have a badly run company in a boom sector and still deliver reasonable returns, which is what they have been doing. There's no other company that I know are suffering those sort of problems, because Bovis has always had inferior metrics ever since the recession started.
Do you think after the fall in the share price there might be prospect of a takeover of Bovis? I mean, some of their shareholders have been wanting it to happen. You might ask what other builder wants to take on a company that has serious production problems, but to the extent they might be addressing those problems, they still own, you know, 5 years worth of, or nearly 5 years worth of land in terms of their production capability. Do you see, you know, a company coming in and picking them up?
Yeah, there were a spate of takeovers. Taylor Woodrow, George Wimpey merged, but most of the mergers have been fairly unsuccessful, simply because there's problems with overlap. In other words, if you buy another builder that's operating in the same area as you, you suddenly have to start rationalising and closing things down. And it's not always immediately obvious how you can get two companies together. You know, Berkeley Group, for example, specialise in inner-city, suburban London. Persimmon, which reports next week, operates exclusively outside London. They're two different animals, really.
Do you think that shareholders should pay much heed to the customer service issues that occasionally break out into the public media, they say the local news media, around house builders? I mean, as part of the nature of new build property is that there are snagging issues and there will be problems sometimes. Is Bovis a case study for why you should take things into account if there's a persistent level of complaints about a company? The scuttlebutt approach, so if you've had a personally bad experience with a company that I know our editor John Heumann likes to talk about. But if you see a lot of news headlines, should you worry about that? Or do you think that's just the nature of house building, is that you will have some dissatisfied customers?
I think you always have dissatisfied customers. About 20 years ago, all the house builders had a reputation for rushing things and building inferior properties. That's changed now. And so, shareholders should be worried because it really shouldn't happen anymore.
Okay, and just to say, we've also got an analysis of Galliford Try and its own house building operation. Linden Homes is doing very well there and offsetting some of the problems that they have nagging in their construction business. Okay, thanks, Jonas. Well, the cover feature this week is called Inflation Proof Your Portfolio. There's a special podcast dedicated to the subject that Kate Bealey has put together, looking at how investors can inflation proof their portfolio and the kind of funds and strategies they can put into place. So do have a listen to that. Emma, now you wrote a part of the feature relating to the stocks that company investors can buy if they're looking to protect their shareholdings from the effects of inflation. Now, Harold Wilson said the pound in your pocket has not been devalued, but anyone that's wanted to go out and buy some Marmite or other products might be finding that it doesn't quite go as far. What are the criteria you use to judge how a company might be able to insulate itself from the effect of rising prices?
So there's a few, in terms of I looked at equities, there's a few kind of characteristics that most people would say a company would have, and they would be able to resist the impact of inflation and kind of rising input costs. That's the big worry for a lot of companies, and kind of squeezing their profit margins. So I guess the biggest one would be pricing power. Which is funny, we talked about Unilever earlier because they are considered to be a company that does have really good pricing power because they have such strong brands.
Although that was very much tested last year, wasn't it, in Marmite Gate, as I
well, I guess, yeah. So that is quite a funny example, but a lot of people I spoke to did still say they think that it's, you know, it's brands who that are so well known to all of us make it a company that would have pricing power. But really, when you look at a company that when you're trying to determine whether a company does have good pricing power, gross margins is a big thing that you would look at. So not just how high their gross margins are, but actually how consistent their margins are. So I actually carried out a little stock screen, and one of the criteria was, you know, within the past 5 years that their profit margins, their gross profit margins wouldn't have fallen by more than, I think it was 5%, because consistency is a really big issue, I think. So you can get a company that might not have astronomical gross profit margins, but it's always consistent.
You also have a criterion in here around the annual growth rate in the dividend.
Yeah, that's a really important thing also, because I think what's a good kind of dividend and a good dividend cover, which is obviously very important, what that shows is that companies' cash flow is sufficient and consistently sufficient enough to be able to continue increasing their dividends over a certain period. And I think we looked at 10 years, and obviously dividend cover was, like I said, a big issue with that as well. This just shows that you've got good cash flow, again, with the profit margins, that they're more resilient to inflation typically.
Okay, so one of the companies that comes out of this is Ashtead, on the measure you just discussed, but also on the high, having a high gross margin, strong free cash flow. And what do you think about that business makes it a bit more resilient?
Yeah, Ashtead, that's a company actually that we've covered recently in terms of benefiting from higher inflation, partly linked to Trump and supposed infrastructure spending. Whether that actually happens, I'm not sure. But that company's good because a bit of background about Ashtead. Basically, they're a tool hire company. They operate predominantly in the US, but they also have some UK operations. Like you say, they have very high profit margins. They have very good cash flow also. They grow predominantly through they call same store growth, which is basically increasing the fleet size within their existing stores. So that's a way they kind of keep costs down. Again, they've kind of delivered very reliable growth over, I would say, the past kind of 3-4 years. Their share price has actually done phenomenally well, particularly during the past 12 months, because again, they are considered to be a company that will benefit from rising inflation.
Okay, fascinating. And we also have a column from Chris Dillo in the piece talking about, well, the economic picture as he sees it and how it relates to prices.
Yeah, he kind of gives a bit about, you know, historically, the kind of trends that we've seen kind of link with different asset classes and inflation. And actually, relating it back to the situation we've got now and maybe why actually we're in a bit of a different situation. So that's interesting. And then Kate talks a bit about kind of bonds and other assets.
Yeah, some of the funds that you can buy if you want to protect yourself too, which I think she further discusses on the podcast. Okay, well, that's all we have time for today, but there's plenty more in there. We have an interesting new spotlight on the business rate reform, which has been very topical at the moment, and how far UK retail as a sector is going to be able to withstand the impact. We've also got, you know, quite a few profit warnings in there relating to different companies, and there's a couple of pieces including Bearball talking about Kraft Heinz and Unilever. There's plenty of analysis of that, and I believe Simon Thompson is writing about Bolevin and a shareholder spat there that's very spicy. So that's it, £4.90 in all good newsagents, and we'll see you next week.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.